This is Soulful Living on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Terry Williams.
Hey, wherever you are in the world today, I welcome you to another 30 minutes of Soulful Living here at Empower Radio. Today, we're going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about experiences that come along near death or just prior to death. My guest, Lisa Smart, has just released an amazing book called Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And as the youngest of six from a huge Catholic family, there's a lot of it that I could relate to. Also as a shamanic practitioner, because a lot of what I sensed as I was reading this are experiences that I've experienced during a shamanic journey. Two of my own examples I'll give is when my grandfather died, it was 28, 29 years ago, and my whole life, I never once heard him say, I love you, to anyone. And he was in hospice care, and I went up to see him, and the day before he died, I just said, hey, I love you, Granddad. And he looked at me, like, I'm getting a little emotional here, sorry, but he was very close to death. He was in hospice, and he had esophageal cancer, but he looked at me, and he opened his eyes, and he said, I love you too, honey. And it was the first time in my life I had ever heard that. Then it totally took me by surprise, and I didn't even know if I was dreaming it or not. I remember sharing it with my mom, and my mom had even said, gosh, I don't remember him ever telling me he loved me. Come to understand, and gosh, with Lisa's book, you'll understand even more, that things happen when we're close to death. Some things we can't explain, obviously, because we're not really in it. So I'm going to let Lisa explain it a little bit more. So welcome to Soulful Living, Lisa.
Thank you, Terry. What a beautiful story. I got tingles as you spoke it. And no matter how many of these stories or accounts that I hear about final words, I'm still sitting in awe of what happens as we cross the threshold and how language and our perceptions shift in those final days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am totally on the verge of tears right now thinking about that experience. And when your publicist reached out to me, I read just the intro and I'm sobbing, and I emailed her back and I said, absolutely, let me get her on as soon as possible. Okay. Because I could relate to it, and I'm sure hundreds, if not thousands, of other people can relate to that. So let's give the listeners an idea of what the Final Words Project is all about.
The Final Words Project is an informal research project. What I've done is I've collected people's accounts, like your story that you just shared right now. And my background is in linguistics. So I'm using what I was trained to do. That is, I take all the tools I've learned as a linguist as I look at these final words, and I begin to find the patterns. And like so many things that have gone unstudied formally, I mean, no one's done research in final words. There's been tons of research, of course, in the first things we say as toddlers and infants and language acquisition. Mm-hmm. But I came to find that there was very, very little. So the final words is a research project to gather, collect, and analyze people's final words and final communications, because it isn't always words in those final days.
Right. You talk about that as well, which I thought was fascinating. And, you know, you mentioned we study children's first words, and we study a lot of near-death experiences. You know, we hear a lot about, oh, I saw the light, and, you know, I went into the light, and this is what happened. Nobody has really gotten into the groundbreaking research that you've done. Every chapter that I read, I was fascinated by experiences that I've had in my own life, but never really thought or talked about them.
Oh, I'm so glad that the book resonated that way with you. And, yeah, well, what happened to me is as I was watching my father pass in the last 3 weeks of his life, I noticed remarkable changes in his language. And I never thought that I would be studying final words. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, I had never imagined this is something I would be doing. But as I watched my father's language shift, my father was a complete skeptic. You know, mm-hmm. He was someone who did not believe in any world beyond this. And so he started speaking about angels in his last 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And his language became almost poetic and nonsensical and very intriguing. So, you know, I never imagined I'd be doing this research. And what's fascinating and what happens when we do research is those experiences that seem so unique and so personal, once we begin to collect data and getting an overview, we begin to see that there might be universal threads, mm-hmm. or at least threads in English. You know, one of the things, of course, now I'm curious about is my hope for the future is I'll begin to look at people's final words in other languages. And will we see some of the same patterns, such as metaphors about travel, or people speaking about moving out of their bodies, you know, and talking about being up on the ceiling, or, you know, they talk about where they are in space in different ways, for example. Will we see universals as we look at other languages or not? And so that, of course, is something I'm curious about too now.
I would have to say that absolutely we will understand that and see those patterns happen from a shamanic perspective. In the cultures that I've studied, each and every culture, each and every shamanic practitioner practices similar to the way I do. And over the course of time, you can see the patterns and the similarities, right? So
absolutely.
To me, it has to be a universal experience. And that's what I feel about your work. Okay, so we talked about near-death experiences. You actually created the Final Words Project with Raymond Moody, who coined that term. How did that happen? How did you two get together?
It was just a series of synchronicities that led to a remarkable partnership and friendship. I read Moody's book when I was 17, and like so many of us who read Life After Life, we read it with awe because it was a groundbreaking study where he coined the term near-death experience. So after I watched the shift in my father's language and was very curious about it, I went to the library at UC Berkeley. I studied linguistics to find out more information about end-of-life linguistics and speech, assuming that there was going to be plenty about it, and there was nothing. So I began to reread some of the things I read when I was younger, and one of those books was Moody's Life After Life. Synchronistically, a friend of my mother's was going to teach a class with Raymond Moody in Alabama. And I said, why don't you just go and meet the man? And I thought, great. And then 2 days later, my tax refund came for $2,000. And so I had just the amount of money, which also seemed very synchronistic. Jumped on an airplane and went to a 5-day retreat to meet Raymond Moody. And on the fourth day of the retreat, he shared with the group that his original interest was actually in nonsense and unintelligible language, such as Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, you know, where the language is nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked about his interest and how actually his interest in unintelligibility, he has a PhD in philosophy in addition to his MD. And he talked about his interest in unintelligibility led to his discerning the near-death experience. Because as he was a medical student, when people would die and then come back, they started speaking in really mysterious ways about their experiences, and it started to sound to him like nonsense. For example, I never felt as alive as when I was dead.
Mm.
You know, that almost has that quality of Alice in Wonderland, you know, that kind of funny speak, right? That nonsense,
mm-hmm.
that almost whimsical. People communicated without talking, right? On the other side, people would talk to me and this profound communication, but no one said a word. Right? So there were these really strange sentences, and he started writing them down. There was a tunnel where? In the middle of where? So as he wrote down this so-called nonsense, he found patterns that then became the near-death experience. Like, I left my body and looked down at myself. So he has a respect for nonsense. He understands, as a linguist understands, that there's no bad language, right? All language, you know, we as human beings are as capable of speaking nonsense as we are sensical language. It seems to be as much a part of the human experience to see things nonsensically, or what we think of as nonsense, as it is to speak of things sensically. And, you know, if you look at a lot of mystical or shamanic language, incantational language, a lot of it is nonsensical, or even something like a koan, you know, the sound of one hand clapping. Technically, that's nonsense. And we know that language that's nonsensical is oftentimes associated with cross-dimensional experience, right? Even if you think as a kid, remember when we used to say things like Shazam, right? Abracadabra.
Right.
So, you know, and there's this whole kind of connection between language that's nonsensical and moving through portals. So as I looked at the language of end of life, and Raymond spoke about this a little bit at that seminar, that language of crossing dimensions seems to often have this nonsensical quality. And so I looked back as he was speaking at my father's final words, and many of the things he said seemed or nonsensical, such as my modality is broken, right? That's nonsense. Our introductory offer, store is closing for goods and services. He said these things that seem like nonsense, but as Raymond talked about the cross-dimensional quality of nonsense, I became very intrigued. And afterwards, he and I spoke, and we developed a friendship and interest in each other's perspectives. And soon after, I left California, where I was living, and moved to Georgia so I could work with him and learn from him. And it's been a remarkable mentorship. I'm very grateful for it.
It must have been amazing. And the fact that you guys have continued this friendship on is really beautiful, a great way to both educate each other. You know, the things that you experience being able to share with him is amazing. And I know he did, he was one of the testaments in the intro in your book, which was really wonderful. You know, you talk about this nonsense, and a lot of people attribute that to medications and delirium, right? Which I'm sure much of it is. However, so much of it isn't.
Exactly. You know, it's so, as I was saying, if you look at isolated cases, if you hear your loved ones speaking in ways that sound delirious and don't make sense, it's really easy just to say, oh my God, it's the meds. But when you start seeing that there are patterns in those nonsensical statements, you have to think, so for example, there are several kinds of patterns we discern. One is what I call a hybrid sentence. So someone may say something that is partly rooted in the seen world, in the world that we all, in this reality, and then another part of the sentence is in another reality. So for example, get me my camera. I need to get a picture of this. Mm-hmm. Well, there's really no this. It's a this that they see. Or pointing to the ladders outside the window. Get me the ladder. I need it to climb up.
Mm-hmm.
So those are hybrid sentences, which if there's an unseen component that is very real. Get me my checkbook. I have to pay at the gate. Things like that, where they combine one foot in this reality and one foot in another reality. And what I heard from hospice nurses whom I interviewed, they said that the kind of delirious statements or the statements that comes from medications, oftentimes they call those hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
They're oftentimes not very lucid. The person cannot move in and out of the hallucination and then the real world, or what we think of as this literal real world. But with visions, when people have more of these hybrid sentences or visions of, oh, here's mom. Mom is here at my bedside, which is very common, seeing visitations and visitors.
Mm-hmm.
That when people have these kinds of visions, first of all, they speak in complete sentences more frequently, and they move in and out. So, for example, while my father pointed to the angels, he then said to me, "Could you get me a glass of water, honey?" Right? So he can move in and out, whereas with hallucinations, people really seem to be more captive by their hallucinations and don't have that same ability to move between the realms. So something that seems like nonsense, seeing a woman in a blue skirt standing at the foot of the bed, or seeing a former loved one who had passed and is now beside the person who's dying, or seeing beautiful landscapes and stepping between these two worlds, that kind of nonsense, or so-called nonsense, exists also at the end of life, but offers the possibility that there might be something cross-dimensional that becomes clearer as we cross the threshold.
Well, and I like how you put it, you know, you have one foot in this reality and one foot in another. From a shamanic perspective, I always tell people, oh yeah, I work in this, you know, in this reality, ordinary reality and non-ordinary reality. And what I see on the other side is nothing compared to what's here, you
wow.
know? So I really like how you said that. How many different cases would you say that you analyzed, you know, that you worked with in pulling all of this together?
We were up to about just this. I keep getting more accounts as I speak about the book, which is so exciting. So we're up to about 165 cases, but it represents now almost 2,000 utterances.
Wow.
And it's really exciting because as I'm speaking to people, my mind is very open. I mean, I'm very open to hearing that something is off base, and I'm always checking with hospice nurses and so forth I want the whole picture. I want to make sure everything's represented. But, you know, it's really remarkable. The more data I'm collecting, the more the patterns seem to be confirmed. One thing about the data is that, you know, people who share their stories with me, and this is very informal. This is not a, you know, scientific, academic, rigorous research. These are more anecdotal and come from conversations. So, you know, they may be skewed to accounts that are more positive in a sense. I mean, there are stories of people who, of course, don't speak at all in their final weeks or days. There are stories of people who say things such as, "Help me, help me." Mm-hmm. But the majority of accounts that I'm hearing that are so remarkable is that people seem to turn the corner as they're dying. Because, of course, people often go through a period where it's scary and there's anxiety. But there seems to be this turn where people begin to have visions and begin to feel the presence of those who have left before them that offers tremendous comfort. So one woman explained how her mother was really struggling and having some anxiety as her final days were approaching. And then one day she turned to her daughter and said, "Earl is here." And Earl was the father who had passed on. And she began to talk to Earl and then turned to her daughter and said, "Oh my gosh, this is so much more comforting. I feel so much comfort now."
Yeah.
And as I look at the accounts, it seems that people that were almost programmed or wired to have these experiences to make our transition, our passing, something not really frightening, but actually quite remarkable.
I think that we are, society has trained us, for lack of a better way of expressing it, early, that death is something to be afraid of. And the more that we learn, the more that people like you share their work and their own research, we learn that there's really nothing to be afraid of. You know, you talk about so many different things in there. One of the things that really jumped out to me was the seeming lack of auditory speaking, almost like people would say that they witnessed, you know, they saw their mother talking to them, but her mouth wasn't moving. It was more telepathic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was amazing.
Yes. That one of the surprises for me in this research, and there were many things that surprised me, but one of the things that surprised me is I interviewed these these nurses, many nurses, and more than I would have expected, shared stories with me of how they were communicating or could hear their patients telepathically and knew what was going on with them. And they wouldn't really speak about it all openly because they felt kind of embarrassed about it because it's so contrary to the medical model.
Mm-hmm.
And they would really be in tune with their patients in ways that that go beyond what we think of in terms of communication in the literal sense.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of family members, when I asked them about some of the nonsense, now many people were afraid of the nonsense they heard. But there were many others, too, who just had this sort of intuition of what their loved ones were saying. And we also know from research that parents or infants and parents seem to have kind of a telepathic bond because children and parents or infants and parents really seem to be in tune in a way that's not verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems we might return to that very same kind of telepathic communication that's also described by people who've had near-death experiences, that universally people explain those communications as being telepathic. So I've really begun to think that there's a whole realm of language that really goes unacknowledged, that is very, very real.
Well, yeah, to kind of digress back to our conversation about, different languages or people getting that nonsense. I think about when you go to church, certain religious affiliations, their parishioners will speak in tongue. They don't even know what they said. They don't know what they're hearing. They just start, rambling off this nonsense, seeming nonsense, which is evident at end of life. And it's hard to think that it doesn't exist, that this intuitive communication or nonverbal communication exists beyond borders. It's funny. This morning I was thinking about that Doctors Without Borders, and then I was thinking it's really like beings without borders, right? It's like beings without borders is what your work is about, whether it's this reality or non-ordinary reality. It's amazing to me. And you even talked about children. So, you brought up the connection between parents and their children, but what about children who have a sense that the end is coming for them, but they don't necessarily know how? I know you did have a couple of examples in the book, but I really found it interesting how young people can sense that it's coming and really not have the words for it.
I think that's very true. I think that is true in a couple of cases. One of a teenage girl who left on the refrigerator within those magnetic, the magnetic poetry tiles.
Yes.
She left this very, it was haunting. She left, I don't have the exact words in front of me this morning, but something like infinite, I'm going to infinite quietude or something like that. And then she tragically died in a car accident on the way to seeing her boyfriend that day or a day later. And her mother just had chills when she saw the words on the refrigerator, and her daughter had also left behind a remarkable poem. So there does seem to be premonitions for younger people and also for adults. And children also seem to have a real eye for the unseen world. There are stories of infants and toddlers being on the bed, sitting bedside with those who are dying. And one man described how the toddler was sort of speaking nonsense, and then the person who was dying was almost in conversation with the toddler.
Oh.
And so his story was really, really fascinating. And then there are several accounts of how children, toddlers especially, could see One toddler came in after her mother had passed and said, oh my God, look at all the birds up there. And so children seem to be particularly in tune with the things that we may not always see, maybe the realm that you know as a, in terms of shamanic work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to learn from them, I think.
Well, we're down to the wire here. We only have about a minute and a half left. And I want to thank you so much, Lisa, for being here with me today. Listeners, you can find all of Lisa's information on the Soulful Living page here at Empower Radio. We'll have links to her website and links to her book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And Lisa, I love for my guests to leave the listeners with something they can take out into the day to elevate their soul or empower them. What would you have to offer loved ones or anybody really in that's experiencing this on how they can move with a little bit more ease and grace?
I would invite people to see all language as sacred and treat every syllable as a gift.
I love that. Well, thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.